welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Hello and welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. With me today is my podcast partner, Mike Gianfagna. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Dan.
Our guest today is your friend and mine, Richard Webbert. Rich has more than 29 years of experience working on ASIC designs for such companies as Data General, Stardent, Silicon Graphics, Stratum One, and Cisco Systems. With Richard's deep understanding of the challenges of ASIC design and the industry standards and political dynamics that form and often limit their evolution, he co-founded Semifor specifically to address these challenges. Good morning, Rich, and welcome to our podcast.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Rich, first, we generally ask what brought you to semiconductors, just to get a feeling of how you came to the industry.
Okay. So, realistically, when I came out of school, my first job was a board level design for a desktop workstation. And when we had completed that, we had figured out that the next generation workstation should use some ASICs instead of just the off-the-shelf devices. And I was put in charge of a team to go off and design, and back in those days, these were Gatorades. So we had a Gatorade project. And the reason I was chosen is because I had actually designed Gatorades in college. And so that was the first time as I was getting paid to actually design a semiconductor.
Interesting. So tell us, what led you to start Semifor? I mean, what problem were you trying to solve?
Okay, well, there's two parts to that, to my answer here. The first part is, in general, I had been through a couple of fabless semiconductor companies, and my role there was principal engineer, basically determining how we were going to design our chips. And what I found is, at least in the late 90s and early 2000s, was that as when you start a fabless semiconductor company, there's some part the software you can get from the traditional EDA vendors, but there was a bunch of stuff you needed to actually design a device and actually have a productive fabless semiconductor company that was unavailable. And I had this fantasy that I would build this fabless semiconductor toolkit, you know, start here, and this is everything you need to get your company up and running, at least as far as how you're going to design your chip. Second of all, I had transitions from the system, computer systems design to networking design. And I learned that networking has a lot of registers in the hardware software interface. And I figured the rest of the industry would eventually follow, that every next generation device would have more registers than the previous one. And I knew from my early experience that there was trouble here, especially if everybody was typing everything by hand. And so I founded Semifor with my co-founders to address this issue that was just going to continue to get worse.
Okay, that's great overview, Rich. So, you know, there's a number of standards in the market that kind of get to part of what you're describing there with register management. How is the Semifor approach different than just, quote, using the standards that are out there?
Well, part of what happened when we started Semifor is our company and our team members were very interested in participating in the industry standards. So we've, the Semifor team members and myself participated in many of the standards that have something to do with hardware software interface. And in our journey, what we've discovered is that, yes, there's quite a few standards that have something to do with hardware software interface. They all are different in very subtle ways and have very interesting incompatibilities if you actually look at them with a microscope. And that's, of course, what we have to do at Semifor. We support the standards, and so we know the standards to that level. And the unfortunate thing, they all don't play together very well. And part of what we do at Semifor is try to resolve these inconsistencies. So that's one thing we do. The other thing that we do is all the standards fall short in some way. And our customers, if they stay just using the standards, there would always be something in their project that they couldn't do, or it would be very difficult. And so another thing that we do is we build our system to be a superset of all the standards. In other words, we support the standards, but we go beyond. And what I mean by that is we add features that allow the customers to get their job done today. And what I mean by today is, realistically, a standard is on some sort of like 5-year or more heartbeat, where if a version of a standard isn't quite what you want, you're going to have to wait at least 5 years until that gets resolved. Whereas with the Semaphore product, we control the horizontal and the vertical. And if there's something blocking your team, we can provide that feature almost immediately and get you up and running.
Okay, so it's sort of a superset of everything that's out there. So just for our listeners, the kind of standards you're talking about are things like IP exact, UVM, stuff like that, right? That gets
yes.
at pieces of the problem.
Right,
but unfortunately, so, not the whole problem.
Yeah, so yes, we've been participating in standards since 2008. And we started off with the System RDL Committee in the old Spirit Consortium, and likewise the IP exact. And we're involved with that. And sort of in 2010, UVM was transitioning from just being sort of a framework for initiating and simulations, but to also have a register abstraction layer. And so we were involved in the selection and what became the UVM register abstraction layer. And today we're still involved with that committee to, I guess, you know, our main goal is to somehow nudge all these standards into compliance with one another. And of course, that's a selfish goal because that makes our lives easier. But it would also make our customers' lives easier as well, because they can get their data to move between the standards sort of more seamlessly than it happens today.
Sure. Makes sense. So getting into the product a little bit, you know, without disclosing sensitive information, what kind of companies have used Semaphore's products, and what's been the result of that? What's been the impact?
Okay. So we have a whole spectrum of different size companies and different verticals that those companies are addressing. And so I guess we'll start at the bottom. We've had many startups use our product. And for a startup, this is a good deal, because the Semaphore CSR compiler is the first tool they need to buy, because you use it in the architectural design phase, because the hardware software interface is critical to that. Every bit is a feature in your design, and so you need to know what the bits are and where they are and how they work. And many of the startups that have gone with the CSR compiler have gotten across the finish line, have been bought by larger companies. And so that's one version of success, where you can hit the ground running immediately with the CSR compiler, and it'll carry you through and help you get to an exit. And realistically, the CSR compiler works with all sorts of different aspects of what a digital design organization has to deal with. It's not just the architects or RTL designers or verification engineers or device driver developers or even technical marketing. It's basically a productivity tool for all of those people. And those are important things. So everybody needs to know what the bits are exactly, but in a different way. And the CSR compiler provides that information for the entire company. Now, another scenario is our companies that are working on I guess what we would call very large hardware software designs. And these would be networking companies or companies that have some sort of graphics capability. And we've helped many companies that have these kinds of designs. And in fact, those kind of designs, it's been true for you know, probably decades, that they could not design the chip without automation in the hardware software interface. One example of a networking device that has, sort of the top or largest design is a couple of years ago, one of our customer companies, taped out a device with 5 million 64-bit registers. And it was critical that the CSR compiler was there to help them, especially since they, you know, with that many registers, many bits were changing per hour. And so they had to run the tool thousands of times a day to get their job done.
Okay, that's, well, I get a headache just thinking about something that big. Interesting. So, you know, companies could build tools to do these tasks on their own. I'm sure you've run into that. What's the difference between that approach and using Semaphore?
Okay, that's, of course, a very key question for Semaphore. Realistically, it depends which company you are. If you're a fabless startup, the reality is developing your own tool is going to take time and precious resources away from your company. In other words, you will have to spend at least 6 months developing a tool that you can use to start your project compared to let's just use Semaphore and get started right away. Another issue is that certainly a lot of the homegrown scripts are just basically just that. They're just some scripts slapped together by the engineers that barely work. And one of the big differentiators is that normally self-developed tools are coded to the point where a correct input will get a correct output, you know, eventually, if you develop it long enough. Whereas the CSR compiler, we've spent years making sure that the CSR compiler, you know, creates correct output. And not only that, we do a tremendous amount of analysis on the input to make sure it's self-consistent, correct, and be able to generate a synthesizable design. And so in-house tools usually fall short on the certainly the input checking side or the semantic rule checkings for the design. Another aspect of building it yourself, well, first of all, you need some resources. And I guess I have some experience because I was that clever script writer at various companies that developed the in-house tool. So I'm painfully aware on how much effort that takes. And it's not just one person. It's to get a tool like this up and running, it's always several people. So no matter what you do, you're always looking at several man years of effort to get a script that or a tool that will do this kind of thing. And if you just do the math on, oh, if I have this many guys working for this long on this product or this tool, then that's a huge amount of money. And the other aspect of this kind of work is the hardware software interface and techniques in the hardware software interface and the standards around the hardware software interface are continuously evolving. And so in some sense, a register tool is never finished. And so you have this continuous R&D effort to keep up with the industry. And so doing it yourself takes time, takes people, and realistically, we have had a lot of situations where we've come into a customer that has an existing internal solution where, for whatever reason, they can't move forward. First of all, it's because it's not a very good implementation. Second of all, the people involved may have moved on. And so once your clever script writers leave the company, everybody else is left hanging and wondering what they're going to do next. So those are just a couple of points that we talk about when people suggest that, well, maybe we just do this themselves. And, well, been there, done that, and it's a long journey.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for, so to speak. Yes. There's a lot more going on there than you think. And by the time you find out, it's often too late. The project's behind schedule or messed up in some way. I get it. Yeah. Makes sense.
You know, I've been with several EDA companies that have a similar thing. They're competing against in-house tools. And sometimes it takes in-house tool has to break, or there's something tragic has to happen before they will reevaluate and replace it. But you know, other times there are people that are proactive that see that, you know, the tool won't scale, or they're putting way too much money into the team to support this tool where they could just buy a commercial tool and leverage the experience of all that the customers of that tool, right? Because all your customers benefit from the collaborative effort. But anyway, you know, I wanted to ask one more question about your customers. So I see three types of readers on SemaWiki now. There's the IDMs, big you know, big companies. Then there's the fabless guys. We used to be dominated by the fabless guys, but now the systems guys are doing their own chips, you know, Apple, Tesla and stuff. And we're seeing a flood of systems people, you know, looking at tools and IP and ASIC services and everything on SemiWiki. So how would you break out your customer base? You know, one, the other, all of the above, what kind of mix do you have?
The reality is we have all of the above. I mean, we do have tiny fabless semiconductor companies that are building a device that they're going to sell to customers, and potentially their customer is actually going to write the device driver, not them. So for them, the documenting the hardware software interface is very important. Some of the fabless semiconductor companies are actually tiny systems companies in the sense that they're actually building a device that they're going to put on a board themselves and then sell the finished board. So in that scenario, the device driver writers would probably be in-house. And then sometimes there's fabless semiconductor companies that are building a device, but, and this is probably more common nowadays than in the past, that they're on the hook to deliver the device driver with a device to their customers. And so most of the hardware software development interface development is done in-house. Larger companies that build widgets, complete widgets that have, you know, processors and all sorts of other devices in it, is a rather large fraction of our customer base as well, and especially in the networking and the graphics areas. And this is sort of, I guess, on the side, is realistically this hardware software interface problem is not just semiconductors, it's the entire system. When you're responsible for the whole system, you decide, you know, okay, there's going to be this many processors or this versions or kinds of processors, and there are going to be these special devices and special hardware accelerators, let's say, and you're responsible for gluing that all together and getting it to work and getting some software running on it. And many of the larger companies I work with have that scenario, and that's certainly how I started my career as well, is developing systems and mapping out what the hardware software interface was going to look like for the entire system, not just one specific chip.
Yeah, that's what my guess was. The systems guys seem to have much more knowledge and much more intent on completing their products, you know, within a specific time and specific parameters. And these system guys, yeah, these system guys spend a lot more money too, you know, because they have a lot more to gain, of course, you know, like Apple. I'm like, you know, my goodness, you can't delay an Apple product. And, you know, I've done some work with Google and other companies that are doing, you know, hyperscale stuff, and they're just putting so much money into it and building entire environments. So it's a different approach, you know, whereas other companies used to do homegrown tools and stuff, you know, when we first started EDA, but it's a changing world. So last question, Rich, what does the future hold for Semifore? I mean, what will we see from you over the next 5 years?
So Semifore, like I said before, is one issue that we have is that the environment that we're working in is continuously changing. So the standards we support are always being published. So we have this continuous improvement, well, maybe not just improvement, but maintenance to maintain our compatibility as the entire engineering environment moves forward. So clearly we're going to be very busy doing that. And realistically, there's places for us to grow. Right now we generate a certain set of synthesizable RTL. It's really sufficient for people doing IP blocks, but certainly we're going to be incorporating more and more of the RTL that can be obviously hooked up to the register bits themselves. So that's one direction sort of in the hardware side. And on the software side, of course, there's a lot of room to grow up. In other words, covering more and more of what the device driver development needs. And so that's another direction that we're going. So down hardware, more hardware stuff, and then up more software stuff. And then of course there's sideways, the verification engineers also need help. And there's going to be more and more features that we're going to have to make the verification process more productive.
Oh, great. So this is a good stopping point. Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Rich, for your time. And thanks, everyone, for listening in. And we'll speak with you again next week.
All right. Thank you.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.